Hello and welcome to the Tech and Trees podcast. My name is Pascal Mies, and on Tech and Trees, I talk to climate tech founders, investors, and operators to learn about how we can build better climate tech companies and how we build more of them faster. On this episode, I talk to Kasper Rasmussen, co-founder of Monta. This company from Copenhagen has built a central platform that facilitates the charging process of electric vehicles, making the charging process easier for everyone involved. Thereby, they speed up our transition to an electrified mobility system. Kasper and his team have raised $130 million in a little more than 3 years. To find out how they achieved this and hear about the challenges they faced on the way, listen to Kasper Rasmussen from Monta.
Welcome to Tech and Trees.
Hey Kasper, thank you so much for joining me today. How are you doing?
I'm doing very good, thank you, and thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, thank you for taking the time. Just to start off, I'd like to ask you a few questions to get to know you as a person, actually. And first of all, like, I would just like to know, you know, what does a typical day in your life look like?
Yeah, it's a good question. So today I'm having a dual role here in Monta. So I'm still sitting as CTO and after spending quite a lot of time in engineering and product, and then the CEO role. So I tend to split my day quite a lot. So normally, like the first half of the day is with product engineering, where it's about roadmap, it's about the betting sessions, it's about figuring out what to do and what not to do, talk to some customers. And then the other half of the day is more split across my CEO role, which is talking to different stakeholders around our company, our board, our investors, potential investors, but also meeting large customers. So that's the two things I really enjoy doing a lot. That's product engineering and sales. So that's the two things I tend to put into the day mostly.
Sounds good. And what do you do before and after work, if you're fine to talk about that?
Yes, of course. Yeah, so I have two small boys at soon 5 years and 1.5. So that's my life outside of work normally. They tend to wake up pretty early, so we tend to start like 6 o'clock in the morning, and we have breakfast together. And then it's about a little bit of playtime, and then getting ready for kindergarten and work. And then I drop them off in the kindergarten. Luckily, they're in the same place, daycare and kindergarten, so I can drop them off on the way to work around 8 o'clock, 8:30, and then I go to the office, and then I'm home around 5-6 o'clock. And we have dinner together and a little bit of family time again before they are put to bed. So that's normally my day.
Sounds great. And just to, you know, get a better picture of you as a person, like what personality traits of yours shape, you know, the most how you are in your private and in your work life?
It's a good question. I think like a couple of things, like it's like I'm very hyper focused on things I like doing and attempt to go that direction. Often I'm very kind of motivated by that. So like I tend to kind of the things I don't like doing, I get them assigned to other people, which are also better at solving them often. So that thing about like really understanding what I get energy from and what I lose energy from and prioritizing my day based on that. And then I think as a leader, I've been kind of growing a lot over the last 15 years, where like in the start, I was a very tough or direct manager. And to some degree, I'm still that today, but also much more reflected about what that means to the situation. So I'm very hands-on. I'm happy to just jump in the boat with everyone and help solving the issues. I think that's my background. Is like if I can solve it today, I'm very focused on that. And just find a solution which is better than yesterday.
Yeah, sounds great. No, thank you so much. I would like to talk about Monta, the company that you're building, right? And you've recently seen quite a bit of traction, I'd say, right? Like you increased your revenue 6 times over last year, doubled your headcount, and you also just raised a new round of financing. So in total, I think you've raised about 130 million or so in financing. Correct me if I'm wrong. But I think you probably have quite some ambitious plans waiting for you now. So just to understand what you're doing at Monta, could you tell me what are you doing and who are like the different stakeholders that interact with your product? You know what I mean? So who are the different parties interacting with your product and how do they interact with it?
So Monza is a software platform for EV charging. So we connect the charge points to our platform and then we build, and we have a software suite around that for managing charging stations. And it starts in the simple things with like energy management, there's access management, but then there's payment solutions. But later on, it gets very advanced when you start having a lot of charge points at the sites or very complex organizations. And there's a full aspect towards the grid. There's a full aspect towards fleet managers. So it really is a pretty comprehensive product end to end where we deal with all the charging situations that might be. And that's also the unique thing about Monza today is that we're hardware agnostic to the hardware, but then we work with a lot of different companies which are using our software for charting in many different situations and setups and scenarios. And the second question was around like our stakeholders. The product today is the interface where there's most is the EV drivers. Users can download our product and find charge points and start paying for it. Or if they are at a parking lot where it's Monza charge points and one of our operators running it, there will still be a Monza sticker on the charge point. And they can scan that and get in and start charging. So that's our biggest interfaces to the EV drivers. But it's the site owners, so the ones who are operating the charge points at the different sites, that's our business customers. And they are either direct or they're through charge point operators, which is like solution providers, companies which are putting charging stations up on behalf of other companies and maintaining them. And that tend to be the biggest customer groups as well. So these charge point operators, utilities, or hardware manufacturers is our business channels.
Yeah. And could you now put this into through the context of, let's say, the overall sustainability transition of society, in this case electrification of mobility, right? So like what kind of roadblocker are you removing here?
So we do two things. So one is like we're accelerating the electrification by making it simpler to both set up charging stations. We are democratizing that completely. It shouldn't be that hard to find a electrician and buy some charging stations online and get them set up. But the whole like thing about making it simpler for the users to find charging stations and pay, I think that's a huge one. And why we started Monza was actually in frustration over the user experience for EV drivers. It was built by engineers to engineers. It was very hard to get it to work when you were standing in a charging station. And I was thinking like, if this ever has to be put into scale, this needs to be much simpler. So that was actually the leading point starting in. But in the product today, we also built in different functionality, which is improving this even further. So one is towards smart charging, which means we will monitor the grid, the spot pricing and the CO2 levels. And then we will recommend charging when it's cheap and green. It's actually like 20% of all the charges done on our platform is something we control that way and are optimizing the CO2 on that. And then it's towards the grid, where we are part of the primary reserve today, meaning that we are aggregating all our charge points and giving that flexibility back to the grid. So when there is an over demand, they can ask us to pause from charging. Instead of starting up like a black power plant.
Okay, so you're also kind of extending into like demand response, energy systems, and so on and so forth now, right? But before getting too much into that, maybe I think that might be a bit complicated. I'd like to talk a bit more about the success that you've had so far, right? Like, so as you said, you try to make the whole charging experience like a lot simpler, right? And so right now you're doing like a million monthly charges. You're adding like 1,000 drivers daily. And you have already like operations in 10 different markets and charging points in 20 countries. Hope again, my research is correct here. But you have achieved all of that within a little more, maybe than 3 years, right? So you must clearly be solving a business issue or a burning issue in a way that nobody else did so far, right? So there must be some, otherwise this growth would not really be explainable in my mind. So like how do you explain
what you are doing differently to what has been done before from like a product point of view?
Mm-hmm. So I think we did a few things right. So we are not the first ones in the industry to come in and build software for EV charging, right? So we are more like the second or third generation. And that means that you can come in and kind of learn a little bit from what happened and then build something from start and not have any legacy. So I think the timing in the market was very good. Like a lot of our competitors have been around since 2010, 11, 12, 13, and they're already sitting with a lot of legacy before it actually started to scale. But I think the second part is like we actually didn't get dragged into all the industry standards. Like we just thought about what is the best possible UX user experience to solve this problem. And that's how we started the entire thing. So, and I think that really shows in the product today that we have rethought how easy it can be done, and how how quickly you can get charging stations set up on a platform, where most of our competitors again they didn't have the whole commissioning thought in, so that meant it was a hassle for them to get charging stations online. So we thought this as like a multi-channel platform from the very beginning, thought in different currencies, different countries, different localization topics. And all that came from experience of building a lot of other mobility platforms over the years, which I've been part of. So I think like that's the main things I would say, at least from a product side. But also from a business side, I think we did some good decisions early. We started Monza as a let's fix the charging experience, and we went for the home market. The good thing about the home market is that people are fairly quick to adopt. So if you get successful, you get a lot of users on quickly. And we managed to do that in Denmark. We found a very nice growth hack where you are getting incentivized with some tax money back if you are spending the energy on charging your car. And you can prove that. And we had that fully digitalized in one of the first editions of the product, which made it a lot easier than anyone else. The common way there was go out and take a picture of your meter once a year and send it on an email, and then someone will wire you some money. And we just said, okay, we can read the meters anytime. So right after a charge is completed, we will just wire you the money right away for that charge. And that became a nice little thing here for the Danish market to get started with. And we use that to extend more into business. And then we discovered an interesting thing in the value chain that was like there was the electricians in the industry are kind of the gatekeepers here. No charge points can be put up unless it's a certified electrician. And in the industry, the electricians who are working on EV charging was often the subcontractors for the big CPOs or the big utilities. But all the small electricians out there, the small 2, 5, 10, 20 people companies, they were not really invited to the party. So that was the ones we really went out and kind of engaged with. And that's also small businesses so that they take quick decisions. It's not a long sales cycle. So you go out quickly and can sign a lot of deals. And a lot of them are not going anywhere, but the ones who did succeed went really far with us. So I think that was also a really important thing for us to discover that early.
So your partners kind of grow alongside you, if I understand right. Like the
correct.
Yeah.
And then we use the small electricians to win the bigger electricians, to win the small wholesalers, to win the small utilities, and then that way going up market.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, because it's one thing to build the right product for the market, but you also have to kind of sell it the right way or push it into the market the right way. So could you dive a bit more into how you think about the sales side of Monta? As you said earlier that you enjoy engineering on the one hand, but sales on the other hand. Could you like tell me a bit more about like how you think about selling the product, what kind of frameworks, for example, you apply there?
So I think in the start there was no frameworks or anything like that. It was about like let's meet with a lot of people and let's see if we can have a conversation where we can solve a problem for them. And that meant we were pretty agile in the start. We were listening to a lot of problems and figuring out, okay, is there a way where we can deal with this and the problem? And because we're really good at product engineering, We also made a lot of small adoption for the product to kind of mitigate all the different use cases. And that way won a lot of customers and trust that way. Today we are segmented in three different segments. So it's our commercial segment is the smallest, it's the SMBs. Then we have enterprise segment, which we call mid-market. And then strategic, which is our largest customer groups. The commercial and strategics are selling locally into the markets, and then the strategics are selling globally from headquarter. And where I normally spend most of my time is in the very large accounts. And here, like we are following MedPick today as like a qualification, pattern to detect how far you are in the sales cycles, etc. But that's the sales team running with that. I'm more like just opening some doors and taking some meetings and seeing again how we can solve some problems for the customers. I think my background there is pretty unique and both understanding the product very, very much, but also have a background in enterprise from my old company. So that's what we use today.
Yeah, you're providing the executive presence oversight. I was thinking about like how fast you've grown over these couple of years, right? And I wonder a bit about like how do you manage this kind of growth, right? Because you can try to be in all the details, but I don't know if that's actually possible, right? So how do you think, for example, I mean, like when you grow this fast, as you just described, like a lot of things must work out well, right? But I guess there must be room for mistakes. Mistakes must be made as well to be learned from, right? So like how do you handle making mistakes at Monta? Like what's your culture around that? Like how do you try to handle mistakes maybe also in a positive way? Like would you let me in on your thoughts on that?
So I think that there's probably two different phases of Monta there. So the first phase was like I think the whole concept was like move fast, break things, like let's just get out there trying stuff and if it doesn't work, it doesn't work, and then run to the next one. And then I think here later we are now critical infrastructure. So that means there's a lot of trust in reliability on the product and we need to do things in very, very high quality. So the whole move thing, break things is getting a little bit different now. We still want to move very quickly, but if it's core part of our product, we need to move slow and not make mistakes. It can be very damaged. It can damage us quite a lot if we take thousands of charge points offline or we run wrong payments. So I think that's the two phases. And today, I think the teams are dealing with it very much in terms of like, okay, this is a critical thing. Then there's a lot of extra steps before we can go live. But on the other side of the company, we are still testing out a lot of things. We're still trying to figure out exactly what works and what doesn't work in different markets. Both in marketing and sales, in operations, so that there's a culture for testing out things, and it's okay to make a 80% solution and get it to market.
No, it makes sense. Thank you. And I'm thinking about right now as we're speaking about this, you know, move fast, break things phase. Was there a time when you thought to yourself, "Holy shit! If we do not get this right, we are dead in the water"? And if yes, like what did you learn from that moment maybe to, you know, avoid them in the future or master them better in the future?
So I don't think we have any like near-death experience on this journey so far. I think there's been a couple of funding rounds which have been nerve-breaking in terms of who are we going to partner with? Is it going to work with the price we put or that? But all of them have kind of turned out positive in the end. I think there was a summer in 21 where we just landed our seed round. We were, I think, 10 people, and we grew to like 30, 35 people over a few months. We opened up in Sweden, we opened up in UK, and there was absolutely no structure. There was no like employee handbook. There was no leadership in place. There was nothing written down, no documentation, no onboarding. That was pretty chaotic, we were like 30 people in the office where there was only 16 desks. So people were working from the kitchen and from the couch and from the terrace and everything. And at that point, it was like, okay, we need to really do something now, which is not just adding more head, because it's not really giving a lot of differences here, because we are still the bottlenecks, the early team. Everyone comes to us all the time. So we started adding a bit of structure there and spending invested into people and culture, got a better onboarding set up. And then also, I think the second wave of employees starting to pick more and more up at the same time, and it kind of played out nicely anyway. But that was pretty hectic, I would say.
I can imagine. And I would actually like to ask you another question about this early stage phase of Monta. You spent a considerable chunk of your career at an agency developing apps, eventually becoming a CTO and partner, right? So I wonder, what does it feel like to be at a rather large company, you know, have resources, have a nice office, have certain routines, team structure, and so on and so forth, right? And then at some point you sit with your co-founder together alone at a desk again, having to start up from the ground again. Like, what does that switch feel like?
So this was during COVID. So I think the whole thing about like, it actually meant that we could go back to office again, because we were so few people in the start, where everyone else was not allowed to go to the office because you were more than six people. You couldn't be in the same room, kind of. That was the rule or something. So for a while, it actually was nice to come back to the office and be just a small group and coming in and kind of developing a lot of things together in the start. The whole structure, I don't think I missed in the start, because there was also a little bit what ends up, like when you take the journey to what I did in the last job, where we were 1,200 people in the end. It gets very corporate. There's a lot of structure. There's a lot of politics, and all that just goes away for a while. But we're just so busy, like coding. Like it was just, I think we coded like 16, 18 hours a day for months, just to get the first product out. So I don't think I ever thought much about it after that. But I remember that in maybe February or something, after we've been at it for a few months, it was the first time we hosted like a company catch up, like all hands. And I was like really just turning a screen around at one of the desks. And there was like six people, and we're like, okay, we can just have a company's catch up like this. And that was kind of cool, right? We're used to like big setup, a lot of people online, different offices. So I think it was really cool to go back, and I think I can see it, I can do that again probably. There's something like about getting to a size where you start getting a bit more support as a leader, which is nice, where you get a finance employee, you get a people employee, you have a CEO, etc., which can kind of support with a lot of the things, which is annoying, like having to pay rent and what about the internet and who's cleaning the office and all these things, right? That gets a lot in the end, I think.
You mean you don't want to be cleaning the office yourself? I cannot imagine that.
But also just kind of finding the company who can do that and make sure that works, yeah. And they have the keys and like, you know, all that, right? It's the practicalities. Yes.
Yeah, of course, the practicalities of real life or regular day life, they kind of catch up with you, I guess. I'd like to know, because you mentioned now several times, right, that you've gone through several funding rounds. Like, what do you... Like when you take on VC funding, right? Like you kind of oblige yourself to chase after growth as well, right? And at some point, you know, investors also need to see an exit. So I'd like to know, like, what do you find most rewarding, but also most challenging about building like a VC-backed firm?
I think it fitted our strategy very, very much in the start, where like me and Anders, my co-founder, we were both like, I would say like between 35 and 40 when we started Monta. And it was like, we give it a year and it needs to really show that this have traction. Otherwise, we don't have time and money to sit in a startup like this. So we had that aggressive mindset from the very beginning. So that fitted very well with the VC case. And I think like in the start, the first couple of rounds you do, there's not that much pressure from the new investors coming in. They are more like cheerleaders, kind of supporting you on everything, and everything is good. You can go left, you can go right, you can go up, you can go down. Everything is fine, as long as you just kind of progress, right? And then later it becomes more real. Now there's big money on the table. what is the matrix you need to hit for this to be attractive later on? And that becomes very, there become some numbers you get very obsessed about and you're looking at every day and you're reporting on them. If you miss it with 10%, that's going to be phone calls about what is happening, how do we get it back on track, like et cetera, et cetera. So the pressure for sure comes a bit later, as late, at least what I felt. But I think it's like, so far, I think it's very fair and fine. It kind of makes sure that you also understand that it is a loan or it's like you're taking someone's money. Of course, you need to deliver back eventually. And what is the small steps on the way to get there? I think that's part of it. And I think we've been lucky with some really good investors, which are also pretty long term and are very understanding on the different situations. And then obviously we also have been in a situation where things have been moving up to the right all the time. So that then it's also a bit easier to kind of navigate this. But what I hear from the other portfolios is that even when there's down quarters, they are also very supportive. So I think find the right investors here is the key. Can't be short-sighted. It's a 10-year journey that you need to think of that from day one. The chance that you're going to exit this in 3-5 years is just very, very small.
Yeah. And as you were talking about the metrics that you kind of have to hit right for the later stage investors, like, do you have any kind of North Star metrics that you also use, like for Monta internal communication and so on? So you say, for example, I don't know, like monthly charges or something. Like, what is like your North Star that you're following?
So we look at how many charge points there is on the platform. That's our North Star.
Okay. Yeah. Got it. I'm wondering a bit because, I mean, you've gathered like quite considerable, let's say, leadership experience before you started Monta, right? Like you just said, you and your co-founder were like between 35 and 40 when you started the company. So I wonder, like, what kind of leadership principles or, let's say, mental models have you developed at your previous job that you try to actively, like, you know, apply at Monta?
I think like I'm pretty happy that I did the agency experience first. Otherwise, I don't think it would have been possible to grow this as quick as possible. Because for a long time, it felt like, okay, this is something I've seen before. This is the options there is to go around it. And also all these small things you might feel like this is taking a lot of your energy to create a rolling budget or to figure out how you create an employee contract, or what is a warrant program and all that, you kind of have that experience. And like, if you don't have that experience, I will definitely recommend that you go on a more easy growth where you can learn this on the way, because you will have to understand what our P&L is and what does A, B, and C mean, and how do you solve different things, and what is GDPR, and how do you do all these things, right? So I think that, yeah, we've seen a lot of that before, and I think as I mentioned earlier, like I think my leadership style have changed a lot over the last 15 years. Being this really like my way or no way, straight shooter, very direct, very into details, person, and then like I remember waking up one morning and saying like, I don't want to be running around in the office always and be angry. Like, kind of just chill a little bit, and then I'm sure that we're going to be close to the same performance without me being a hawk sitting on top of everyone. And then maybe I'm actually going to enjoy the day as well a little bit more, and be kind of giving a positive aura around me instead, and that might counter some of the details we miss here and there. So that's been my leadership style here is we always have a solution. Come to me if there's a problem. I'm happy to jump into the boat and figure it out together. Like, but if I don't know about it, then I can't obviously help. And then like hire smart people and let them do what they should do. Like that, I think that's the trick. Like in many things, right? Of course, you can talk about things you want to see from the finance department or the people department, or how the work experience is, or things you have opinions about. But day to day, like, stay out of it. They will figure out to get to the same results. There might be a detour on the way, but then they have full ownership of it afterwards, and that's worth that detour.
How do you approach hiring? And because you say, you know, like, okay, just hire smart people. I mean, there are a lot of, like, that's easier said than done, right?
It's a very,
like, what are you looking for in people?
I think it still varies a lot, right? Like, I think this interview process needs to exist of a few things, right? There needs to be some kind of cultural fit and some kind of like ambition match to what you're looking for. Then obviously there needs to be something on the I'll say like the practical side. Can they actually code in that language you're hiring them for? Can they design in Figma? Have they any experience with that, or do we need to do budgets or whatnot, right? But I probably interviewed thousands of people over the years, and there is a little bit to that, like within the first 15 to 30 minutes you have a really good idea if this is someone you're going to be happy working with, and if it's someone who is going to add something you can't. So it depends on like if when you're CEO you're going to hire people in roles where you don't actually have knowledge about how it's done right. So there it's a bit more on the gut feeling, and you need to get others to kind of validate that they have the skills within finance or legal or whatnot. And if it's within your own practice, right, then you can be much more on like, okay, let's talk tech here, like figure out what if this person actually knows what they're talking about. So I think it's a super tough one, and I think even with a really good process, you don't get it right 100% of the time, but then adjust really quickly when people start working. That's I think that's the way I see it. Like when I hired our CEO Max, then like we didn't even specify the role a lot. It was just like, come in and work here 3 months. In those 3 months, we'll figure out if we like working together, and we'll figure out what the role ends up being. And of course, he wanted to have a little bit of perspective of what that could mean, so he doesn't spend 3 months of his life and not go anywhere. But that was like, I think those kind of things is the best process for me. Like, get into it, start working together. You will very quickly discover, are you going to trust this person enough after 2 weeks to actually let them set up our UK entity and find the country manager there? Because then they're probably someone you should work with for many years.
Yeah. Do you have any, let's say, special way or any kind of sources of learning or self-reflection that you use? Because you said, you know, your leadership style has changed a lot over the years. So there must have been like some kind of reflection process there. But also that you said now that you brought in another CEO, right? That also takes some reflection in terms of, okay, what are your own strengths as well as weaknesses, right? So how do you go about like reflecting on your next steps, but also like how you can improve?
I think that the reflection is important. That like, and I think you can in the start you should do it retrospective. So something happened, or someone made a mistake, or like we lost a customer or whatnot. And then the way you dealt with the situation, you can see how it impacts the team afterwards. Right? And then you should talk to the team, but also to your peers around. Like, okay, was that the best way that it could have been handled? And then when you get a bit more advanced in that, you can do it up front. You can say, okay, now we have the situation. This is either how it can go, right? If we go down this route and we are like, okay, we're going to be hard on them on the mistake, that means this and this will happen and this, they will be demotivated. There might be next time there's a problem like that, they might not they might not go for it, and because they are going to be scared about what happens with the mistakes, that's right. So do you kind of thinking that way, and my CEO Max and me does that quite a lot, right? When there's a thing landing on our table, like when we discuss these things together and saying, okay, what would that impact the different people around it, and then try to make the decision based on that. But in terms of leadership style, like I think it's just some of the things you learn. Like if you sit and try to optimize, that was what I felt like. For a long time in my old company, I felt like I had a really strong team, like 80, 85, 90% on the scale. But then every year I was like, okay, how can I get it to 92? How can I get to 93? And you try to optimize for that, and you end up doing more damage, because then you end up letting someone go, which actually had a good relation to 4 other people, or there was one thing you missed, that person was the best at certain things. And now you have that gap. So that was the thing, like accepting that it's never going to be perfect, and that if you have a 80% or 90% solution, that's good. And then it's about how you manage that day to day. and play everyone good. And then like the thing about like your mood is going to be very important to how much impacts everyone around you. So if you run around in the office are angry all the time, it's not a good work environment for anyone.
Bunch of angry people can also unleash a lot of energy, but I fully agree. I wonder as you spoke about like how you think about the different consequences, right? Now that you're looking at a rather steep growth trajectory, like how do you make sure that you focus on the right things? Like how do you distinguish between the very small fires that can, you know, keep burning and that are not really worth your attention? And what are the crucial things that you really need to focus on?
Yeah, it's a good question again. And I think that like that's what you end up spending a lot of your energy on, figuring out, okay, is this actually worth your time now? Or should we just let it run out? But I think it's like the initiative you're going for is equally right. It's like you really only have time available with your team, and it's about getting the most out of it. And that's the prioritization, but also how efficient is it? How good are you at executing? And in Monte, we had like a mantra from the start about like we really execute us. So when our competitors are trying out, let's say, 4 things, we try out 15 things. And that way we'll always kind of come out on the top side here. And we tend to do that still. We're still very much into execution instead of kind of strategizing around it, then just go out and test it out. But yeah, it's a dilemma for every leader or manager every day, what to spend time on, what not to spend time on. Right now, it's a big topic for us to what we call context switching. Trying to really minimize the context switching for everyone in the company and the interruptions there is. When you are 220 people, suddenly Slack is very problematic. There's a lot of interruptions coming from that. How do you build a good company where people can still communicate and they can get answers to the things they need without interrupting 200 people every time? That's some of the topics. But yeah.
But that also sounds as if you're very deliberate about the kind of culture that you're trying to cultivate, right? The principles that people follow when they think, right? Like you said, okay, you want to try out 15 things when your competitors try out 5 things, right? But also in terms of context switching, trying to really cultivate a culture of focus and like an environment that does not disturb people when they should not be disturbed, right? Could you talk to me a bit about like how you think about, you know, programming this kind of culture that you have at Monta?
Mm-hmm. So I think the some of the things actually is not necessarily coming from us, right? We can see that we grew the product engineering team quite a lot, and like in the start it was super agile, and like, we just decided on the morning what we were doing. Then later we moved into like smaller sprints, and then later as the team grew, there just sort of came more and more requirements from each other of the different squads saying, we also need that from you and you need to deliver that for us. And suddenly a lot of the pressure came from other parts of the organization, not the customers. And then you need to regroup again and say, okay, now we need longer sprints. We need sprint planning. We need to have something working across the different squads, etc. So it's not all like I think the thing about that you should sit and foresee what problems there's going to be in 1, 2, 3, 5 months. Like everyone wants to, of course, be able to do that, but sometimes you can also just solve a problem before it ends up being a problem. And sometimes you should just let the problem be for a little bit, because then solutions will actually appear from the team. Again, if you hire smart people, they're not going to be happy by working in an inefficient environment where they spend all the time in meetings instead of delivery. And then some of these things would like communication and interruptions. That's a topic we've been kind of working on both with the people team, but also in C-level a lot, because I just know it from experience that if you don't get that solved quickly, then you end up in this meeting culture where everyone is just doing everything else than they're assigned to, and you don't move anywhere.
Yeah, no, makes sense. Thank you. I'm slowly but surely coming to an end, and I guess you're happy about that because then you have time to spend building Monta. But I just, for like my last question, I would like you to put yourself into my shoes. So you're just fresh out of university, basically, and taking your first steps in, like, let's say, the real world. Do you have any life advice?
Oh, dropped out. You said any life advice?
Yeah. What's your advice for someone like me who, you know, is just fresh out of university, taking his first steps in the real world? Like, what's what would you like to have known?
So I think the a good advice is to, like, make sure you pick like your job and your coworkers for where you're gonna learn most in the start. Don't think about the biggest payroll or the biggest pension scheme or the most vacation or whatever that can be, which some of the large corporates are kind of trying to lure you in with. Really pick hard problems with smart people and learn, because that's going to be what you are in 10 years. And the quicker you can accede to that, the better career you will have as well. Make sure to have a lot of fun in the start, right? Because it's that's also part of learning, is to have fun at the same time. And as well, before you get kids and things like that, make sure you see the world and you try a lot of different jobs and a lot of different projects, a lot of different industries. Like, the more differentiating can be, I think the better it is. And that's actually what I liked about the agency life, was that every 6 months, every 9 months, you onto a new customer, which is in a new industry, in a new geographic area. So you saw a lot of things. You worked in a lot of different industries. You tried a lot of things out. You saw what worked, what didn't work. We built hundreds of mobile apps for companies which bankrupt. And that was just part of it. So I think that's number one. And then I think with management, I think take it easy. Like, it's way harder than what you think to kind of get into it and get good at it. So start with 1, 2, 3, 4 people slowly and spend years on that. And then before you suddenly sit in a team with 20, 30 people, because if you don't have the tool set for that, it's going to be bad for you. It's going to be bad for the employees and the company. And if you are a founder where suddenly it takes off quickly, then get help. Like, make sure you hire people which are more senior than you. Get a good people person in, VP of people or something like that, head of people. And if you're into product engineering, you can be an amazing CEO, but make sure you cover the business side with someone else, like a COO or a CRO or something like that in as well.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. Thank you so much, Casper. Thank you so much for taking the time. This was awesome. So all the best for you and all the best for Monta.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me.